I'd like to thank the organizers for putting together such a great, exciting workshop. I learned a lot from several speakers. I hope I could contribute to this excitement. Well, part of the work that I'm going to present today was carried out in collaboration with a couple of my graduate students, Gustavo Carey, CY alias Joey Kong. And some of the key references are you can lift it from the website, which will be posted. Given the general theme of the workshop, if you look up your typical textbook in biology, you come up with a typical cartoon, which looks something like this. And after thumbing through these books for a while, hundreds of pages, the first thing that strikes you would be that this is actually a Coulomb soup. Now I could take this point and put it anywhere here, and that would be a polyelectrolyte. Okay, so that's the first message. The second message that would strike you would be that this is a very crowded environment. In fact, suppose I take synthesis of a protein, which all of us know to be a polyelectrolyte charge, let's assume that's being synthesized somewhere here near ER, and that would eventually, somehow, it gets into, say, the Golgi apparatus, and it'll be sorted out and dispatched to the final destination. And the questions that we would ask ourselves would be then, how do these guys have their structure? How do they move? How do they dynamically transport themselves from one location to another location in such a crowded environment? And when I say crowded environment, I'm really very serious here, because suppose I take a typical mammalian nucleus inside a cell. The typical diameter would be 6 microns, and we are talking about 1.8 meter DNA being condensed in this. From DNA alone, the density is about 100 milligrams per milliliter. But in addition to that, there are tons of proteins and various other polyelectrolytes in the system. So let me again take a little bit a closer look at what's happening here, particularly from the chromosome point of view. There is a tremendous amount of play. There is an enormous amount of dynamical freedom for these objects to move around. If I look at the mitotic phase of the cell cycle, which is only over 4% of the lifetime of the cycle, it is in a very dense state. And this is like one very large DNA molecule, complex with hundreds of proteins to make such a very beautiful, very compact structure. And what is striking when you look at this picture is, so that there are many loops, and there are millions of loops that are formed in here. And if I walk along this loop, the length of this loop is very long in comparison with the persistent length. So the tantalizing question is, yes, it is all very difficult and complicated. Would we be able to brave enough to look at this from entropy point of view? Can we try to just make zeroth order attempt to look at some of these structures? So that's the question that we can entertain ourselves. The other thing that happens is, for the rest of the time where the replication is taking place, these loops are distributed. They're distributed in a very nice way. For example, they are distributed in terms of heterochromatin and homochromatin. The dark area that you see would be called heterochromatin near nuclear envelope in here, as well as inside this nucleus with lots of proteins. And the density of the DNA in those heterochromatin domains would be comparable to this. The area that you see white, there is also DNA, but that's the euchromatin, where the density of this DNA is small, and there are lots of loops. So there is a distribution of these loops back and forth in here, and during the cycle, you know, this gets converted into this, and eventually this gets converted into this, and there is tremendous amount of play. So, in fact, some of the simple models that people would like to base upon empiricism from experimental data, the kind of models that you could propose would be something like here. There are lots of loops. It is a part of this chromosome. And that's the protein, a large number of proteins in the anchoring complex, and there are lots of loops, very long loops, compared to the person length of this DNA. And then these guys are condensed to make very nice chromosome. So basically, the kind of questions that come about, as soon as you see these things, my immediate reaction would be, forget about this problem. This is too hard. Just to go away. Right. But on the other hand, But let's just try to make the simplest kind of a description and see how far we can go. Is there a possibility? So what are the key issues here? Number one, it's a Coulomb soup. Number two, it's a very crowded environment. Number three, there is tremendous amount of complexation between oppositely charged entities. And then there is also cooperativity. And there is very controlled distribution of these loops from a very condensed state to a less condensed state. And the length of these polymers are very long in comparison with this, the range over which specific details are taking place. So the question here is, can you think of some minimal representation of these things with the fewest parameters and try to have some idea about what's going on here? Given these things, the questions that I ask myself are the following. The first question is, how can we, one of the mechanisms by which we can make these compact structures is to condense these polymers near a surface. And the questions are the following. This is a very long polymer, and there are, of course, a tremendous amount of details, even for a single polymer chain, as we saw in the previous lecture by Kurt. Let's assume, due to various mechanisms, current ion condensation, effective dielectric constant, and different temperatures perhaps, you know, on and on, and different environments, let's assume this polyelectrolyte is uniformly charged with some charge density Q. And what happens, can we describe this in simple terms of how this polymer chain is condensed to a surface with opposite charges with some its own density? It doesn't have to be uniformly distributed. The charges need not to be uniformly distributed. We can even have patterns, you know, heterogeneity on the surface, curvature to this surface. And for such a complicated problems, I want to just look at, I like to do the calculations as much as possible analytically to just get insight about what the general trends are. And therefore, I like to do this problem with a Debye-Hückel description. So the bath in which these large molecules are floating around is described by a Debye-Hückel description. And let's assume the electrostatic interaction is dictated by inverse Debye length kappa. And the questions that we could ask, in addition to what the necessary conditions are for such a complexation to take place, we can also ask whether there are any synergetic competition or synergetic cooperation for promoting some conformational transitions of the polymer induced by the surface. Because the surface would absorb, how does a potential conformational transition, like a Helix-Coil transition, get coupled to an absorption? And we can ask whether there are some opportunities to understand subtle changes, at the same time, very sensitive changes to very chemical potential gradients in terms of ions. And the two other questions which I like to mention here would be in the crowded environments. What would be, when we have a very dense system, what would be the effective potential between, say, two charged groups on a polymer? Either the charged groups will be on the same polymer or different polymers. And then what would be the free energy and what would be the phase diagram for such a system? And again, what would be the collective dynamics? If I were to take some monomers and some volume element, how does that density transport itself from one location to another location? For example, there are very extensive experimental data on dynamic light scattering on such systems, both biological polyelectrolytes as well as synthetic polyelectrolytes. So the questions would be like, what would be the density-density correlation function as a function of time? These are the kind of questions that I'd like to allude to. Now let me take the first question. And for the first question, the strategy that I like to follow is a well-established strategy for polymer physics, particularly for neutral polymers. And I like to see how good this strategy is, this computational strategy is. The strategy is the following. I take a polyelectrolyte, which is uniformly charged, in an electrolytic solution with a Debye length inverse kappa. And the bare Kuhn length is little L. The length of the polymer chain is much large in comparison with this Kuhn length. Already, a charged polymer in isolation is a difficult problem. You know, already an exact solution is not known. So in view of what we want to accomplish, let's make approximations and see how good these approximations are in terms of phenomenology. So the first approximation that I like to do, even before I worry about how this chain is going to be attracted to the surface, is let me assume that this electrostatic interaction has an uniform expansion to the polymer. Due to this electrostatic interaction, due to this potential interaction, the polymer chain expands uniformly. If I make this approximation, technically it becomes easy to do further calculations, because this implies that I can treat this as an effective Gaussian chain. In other words, this Kuhn length now is not simple chemical Kuhn length, but it's a Kuhn length which depends upon ionic strength, charge, molecular weight, and on and on. So this is what I like to do. This is the first approximation I'm going to make. And I'll check whether this is a good approximation or not down the road. Second thing that I will do is, then if I have this, then this length, this little L, is now replaced by L1, but I get rid of this intra-chain interaction part. Okay, that therefore in the absence of the surface, it becomes a simple Gaussian chain, effective Gaussian chain. Then I look at what happens to this Gaussian chain in the presence of the surface. In the surface, we could write the charges any way we like. Let's take uniform charges for the time being, for simplicity's sake. And then, as is familiar to the polymer community, this satisfies this simple time-dependent Schrodinger-like looking equation. And then there is a very simple trick to get rid of d by dt term. L is the contour length of the polymer, proportional molecular weight. And then by integrating out this x and y direction for the charge distribution on the surface, this equation now turns out to be that time with the particle in a box problem. So here is the effective step length, which depends upon the ionic strength of molecular weight. And then this is the potential coming from the surface. For the uniformly charged surface, this potential looks very simple potential like this, e to the minus kappa z, and then inverse kappa here. And the charge density on the surface, charge density on the polymer, Lb is the Behrend length. Then if the temperature is low enough, in biological problems and also polyelectric problems, temperature is not an important variable. It is the charge density and also ionic strength. These are the very important variables. So if the charge density on the surface, which is opposite to that of the polymer, if that is sufficiently large enough, then I would have a bound state or several bound states. So the condition, otherwise, I would have a scattering state. And this is in half-infinite space. The boundary condition for solving this equation is that I have a planar surface in the right of the center here. So the polymer chain is not allowed on this side. So by solving this equation, look for the condition for the first time we would get a bound state. So that's the attempt. If we do this, we can do this calculation exactly with that approximation. If we do this, in spite of the fact that there are many variables in the system, they conspire to give a very simple formula. Charge density on the surface, charge density on the polymer, and they make it dimensionless using d by length, kappa cubed, and that's the Behrend length, and this is the effective step length on the polymer. If this combination is greater than or equal to this number, then we will have adsorption. L1 is the effective step length, which accounts for the intra-chain electrostatic repulsion. Okay, for example, in high fault limit, L1 would go like kappa to the minus 4/5, right, times molecular weight power 1/5. In a low fault limit, it will go like molecular weight power, molecular power 1. So there's a crossover formula for L1. But that depends on molecular weight as well as the ionic strength.
What are the typical scales of L1 in angstrom, nanometers, microns?
Well, little L would be, for polystyrene sulfonate, we are talking about 20 angstroms, little L. Mm-hmm. Okay? And L1 would be larger than 20 angstroms, depending upon the conditions. And Behrend length is of the order of, you know, so. Beg your pardon? L1 depends on molecular weight too.
No, but this is condition depends on molecular
weight. Yes, through L1.
But if L1 is constant, which is a consistent length, then you would double the molecular weight of the
chain. No, L1 would not be a constant.
What?
L1 is the expansion factor. Right? L1 over L would be the expansion factor for the polymer chain in the Fourier language. Okay, so that would depend upon molecular weight. Kappa cubed?
Yeah.
Kappa is the inverse d by length. Since we have seen this so many times, I didn't want to define it again. Okay.
If you're saying it's remaining Gaussian, how are we to imagine it sitting on the surface?
Excuse me. So in this calculation, before, when you look for these bound states, you make the assumption that that condition is not influenced by the possible deformation of the chain by the surface. Okay. But once you cross that condition, threshold condition, then the chain would absorb. When it absorbs, then it will be like a pancake. Yeah. And then you calculate what the density distribution is by looking at the various bound states, going through the spectrum, calculating them, and you can calculate all the quantities that you want. For larger chains, L1 would be larger, depending on the conditions.
Okay, but so for larger chains, larger chains don't convert in your
case? Well, you
have... L1 is larger than the condition would be related. So if you eventually go to very, very large chain, I would not
accept. Well, excuse me. This condition is valid provided you are in the polymeric region. You've got to have a long enough a polymer right. In order for this analysis to be true. Right. In that limit, yes, you are right.
So you're predicting...
That's right, in that limit. Even provided you keep everything else
sure.
The same. Sure. And that's exactly what is observed. Now, in terms of simulations, right, the agreement between this formula, this is the formula that I showed you before, and these are the Monte Carlo simulation data, the agreement is pretty good. But in the simulations, we don't make this assumption that the chain is effective Gaussian. You take the polyelectride with the Debye-Huckel interaction. And therefore, it appears that, at least qualitatively, this is a good way to go about to address such complicated problems. Not only for this problem, this agreement is good, but you can also do a similar calculation for the following situations. Suppose the surface is not uniformly distributed by some charge. Suppose there is a heterogeneity on the surface, whether I have similar charge or opposite charge, or if I have a spherical particle which is uniformly surfaced, or it's covered with a pattern or randomness of the charges, or if the polyelectrolyte is going to be absorbing from the inside of a sphere or inside of a cylinder, we can do very simple particle-in-a-box-like calculation for those geometries, and you can calculate them. And you get very simple formulas. Formulas of this type, I don't expect you to grasp all the implications of this formula. Formulas of this type, for example. These are really very, very simple formulas. Let me just illustrate two examples here. Suppose I have a pattern surface in here, that I can induce the absorption not only through the charge density on the surface or the pattern, charge density on the polymer and the salt conditions and also molecular weight and on, but also I can induce the transition by tuning the size of this patch. And in a similar way, if I have absorbing polymer to a sphere, I can induce a transition by the radius of the sphere. And similarly for a cylinder, on and on. And indeed, as we heard from Paul Dubin, these formulas seem to work very well to capture the essential observations in his experiments, where he was looking at dendrimers, absorbing fluxful polyelectrodes. Again, to give an example of a polyelectrolyte absorbing to a spherical surface, given other conditions, fixed is the charge density on the surface, on the polymer, dielectric constant, that is room temperature, right, on and on. As I told you, I can tune the transition by playing with the radius of the sphere. This is a typical graph. There is a critical radius needed to absorb this polymer as a function of inverse Debye length in units of Kuhn length. This is the typical curve. This is the formula that I showed you before. These are the Monte Carlo simulations. This has an important message. The important message is that if I have a protein or charged particle which is small, in order to get rid of that particle from the polymer, I need to go to this much ionic strength. On the other hand, if I have a bigger particle, which is already complex with the polyelectrolyte, with a bigger radius, then I need to go to higher concentration, higher ionic strength to get rid of this polymer, this object. And this is exactly what is observed in many experimental data. This is, in fact, a principle for protein separation, as well as if you take, there was a discussion earlier, day before yesterday, if you take a histone coming out of nucleosome, H2A, H2B would come off at a low ionic strength, and H3 and H4, which are bigger, would come off at a higher ionic strength. Yeah, Surah.
Did you take L1 to plot this test?
Well, this from the formula. The L1 is derived by the assumption that the chain has a uniform expansion, and using a variational calculation, we calculate this. So we calculate the radius of gyration of this polyelectrolyte under different ionic strengths. Okay, and that formula gets into my formula here. Okay, and in the simulations. there are no assumptions. You know, just a debye call and just a single
label. So the configurational entropic cost of absorption comes through this expansion. When you have a bigger effective persistent price, there's less configurational entropy, less of a price in that way.
That is correct. Yeah. That appears.
So you're backing that out.
Right. Right.
This L is different than L1.
No, this is a Kuhn length. This is a bare Kuhn length. Okay. And that the L1 has already gone into the, you know, plotting this. Okay. So the message that I like to convey here is, it appears that this is a good strategy. This is a very simple back of the envelope type of computation strategy to look at this complexation problem. And that's the message that I want to say. Bill. Right. But we do. Right. Right. This is only the critical condition. I'm giving only the critical condition. While I'm below this critical condition, while I'm in the absorbed state, then we can calculate from this recipe what the density distribution is of monomers away from the surface. And from the simulations, you actually calculate them, you measure them, you monitor them, and you compare. Right. But I did not focus here today. I'm not telling you what's happening in this region. I'm just focusing only on the threshold, the critical condition. For adsorption, for binding. So this is the boundary, that is, right? This is the boundary. If I'm on this region, there will not be complexation. If I am above this, I would have complexation. So I'm showing you. It depends upon every other parameter, not only end dependency, it depends upon charge density, Vrm length, everything. Okay. So there are two messages. It's a good computational simple strategy to capture what's going on. Number two is the assumption that I made that the chain can have uniform expansion. Yes, I think it's a good approximation. Okay, so that gives me a tremendous opportunity to push myself a little bit more to ask more complicated questions, because the effect of Galton, I'm surrogating the ionic strength effect and everything else in terms of Galton, effective Galton propagator. So that allows me to go a little bit beyond to look at the other problems. I'm going very slow in it. That will not be slow enough, I take it. So please interrupt. I don't have to finish everything. So now let me look at the consequence of the presence of helicoil transition near an absorbing surface. Let me tell you the two extremes. This is, I think, a very familiar territory to all of us. But let me tell you what's going on here. Suppose I take a polymer chain which is capable of undergoing helicoil transition. And a typical configuration of this polymer would be like this. It's a coil, 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 helix, helix. And as you know, this is easily mappable into a one-dimensionalizing model. And then with the two parameters, that is the probability to initiate a helix domain, which is called cooperativity parameter, and energy of formation of a helical residue with respect to coil residue, with the two parameters, we can show that you can have this sigmoidal cooperative phase transition. Then epsilon in this description is negative, coil is preferred. When epsilon is a positive, helix is preferred. And the way the steepness of this transition is given by this parameter eta. Now there are many ways to do one-dimensionalizing model. The methodology that I like, because of what I want to do later on, is the following methodology, which is the full Green function is the propagator for, say, rod-like conformation or helical conformation, and then the propagator for the Gaussian-like polymer chain, flexible coil-like region, and then rod-like. And it's possible to sum all these possible configurations exactly with the appropriate propagators. And from this propagator, you can get the partition sum. You get exactly the same answer as everything that we should get. So this is one limit. But I wanted to remind you that There is no true thermodynamic phase transition. Helios coil transition is not a true thermodynamic phase transition. It's in one dimensional system. Now let's go to the other limit. Suppose I have a polymer chain, flexible polymer chain, which is adsorbing to a surface with a some strength, which is C. C is the strength of adsorption per monomer, which is proportional T minus adsorption temperature divided by TA. We have a second order phase transition. Number of monomers for a flexible chain at the surface as a function of temperature, as a function of this parameter, would be following this curve. And that is a multi-critical phenomenon technically, but this is a second order phase transition. Now the question is, what happens when I have a helix coil polymer, a polymer which is able to undergo helix coil transition but coming to the surface? Phenomenologically, from an experimental point of view, we know that in the helical region, if a polymer is able to make a helical domain, that helical domain preferentially goes to the surface. We know that from a Raman and IR studies on polypeptides and polynucleotides. Okay. So the calculation that I like to do, which is an exact calculation here, would be with the following boundary condition. That if the polymer chain undergoes helical, if we make the helical domain, that helical domain would always go to the surface. So whenever I see a helical domain, that will sit on the surface. And then I like to ask the question, what happens to this helix coil transition with that boundary condition? And then I like to look at two possibilities. That is, if the surface is rippling the monomers belonging to the coil domains, or if the surface is attracting the monomers belonging to the coil domains. These are the two limits that I like to look at. Okay. And now let me show you the results. The results are, first of all, I want to tell you, break the good news. The helix coil transition, which is not a true phase transition, gets promoted into a true thermodynamic phase transition because...
That's impossible if it's a finite length.
It's only for infinite, very long lengths.
And the helix coil transition, if you allow for excluded volume, is a true transition also.
Yeah, that is also true, as you showed in the 60s. Yes, I was going to make a comment. Thanks. But already, even in the Gaussian description, we are producing a phase transition. Right. That's right. Okay, so what are the results? The first result is that in the case of an attractive surface, okay, so this is the amount of helix fraction. Now this is the strength of, in log scale, strength of attraction with the surface for the helical monomers. And this is the parameter, epsilon parameter. When epsilon is negative, I told you, intrinsically the polymer likes to make coil. So it's a coil there, when surface is interacting weakly. And when epsilon is positive, it likes to make the rod or helix. So that is the helix coil transition, which is not a phase transition. But now when I increase the strength of the attraction of the surface for the coil monomers, then the helices are wiped out because the monomers like to stick to the wall. So therefore, what happens is the helices disappear at the cost of monomers going to the surface. But for the cooperative parameter being very large, there is no phase transition in this limit. But on the other hand, if you look at a repulsive surface, now what happens is, again, when the strength of the interaction of the surface is weak, that is the helix coil transition. But when the strength of the interaction becomes stronger, there is a cooperativity. That is, there is a competition between the monomers in the coil domain being rippled away from the surface so that they will make very long hairpins, and the ability of the polymer to make the helical domains intrinsically. And it turns out, for the repulsive surface, which is counterintuitive, turns out that that transition, the helix coil transition, gets promoted into a second-order phase transition. And you know, because it's an exact calculation, you can analyze the partition sum. It is indeed a second-order phase transition. And the amount of helical monomers will be zero if epsilon, this parameter epsilon, is less than this line. Epsilon star is equal to minus eta over C. Now let's look at the other limit, which is the adsorption of a flexible polymer chain getting modified by the ability of the polymer to make a helix coil transition. So that is this limit when eta is small. Again, I'm plotting here. Now I'm plotting coil monomers at the surface. And when epsilon is negative, the polymer chain likes to make a coil. Therefore, I'm in the usual second-order phase transition point. So that is the density profile. And C is the temperature variable, T minus TA by TA. When C is equal to 0, I see the second order phase transition. That is the typical, the standard absorption. Now what happens when the polymer chain is able to make a helix? When the polymer chain is able to make a helix, there are two possible scenarios. One possible state is the polymer would like to make the helix. The other possible state is the monomer would go to the surface. So there are two possible possibilities, and that leads to a first order phase transition and the following that green line. And in fact, the consequence of this is the adsorption temperature is suppressed by the ability of the polymer to make the helix coil transition, and one can make the analysis of how these two lines meet, and it's a multi-critical phenomenon, and on. Okay. But the message here is that if this is able to, whenever I have a conformational transition happening in a polymer, but in the proximity of an adsorbing surface, the system becomes extremely sensitive to the values of the parameters. And I believe that by playing with ionic strength gradients, you can move from one place to another very easily in the system. And I believe Mother Nature uses this game. And indeed, along these lines, let me make a very quick remark. Along these lines, you could also try to sum up the various loops that I told you about between the mitotic chromosome and an interface chromosome. And I don't want to elaborate on this because I want to cover the other topic that I want to tell you about. I'll be very happy to discuss later on. So you can parameterize, you can sum all these diagrams, all these configurations. You can come up with two parameters to describe how the system goes from this kind of very nice, this kind of a configuration to this multiple distribution, multiple loops. Okay. Now let me go to the crowded environment. In the crowded environment, one of the expectations that I have, any description of a polyelectrolyte, either equilibrium or dynamics, in a crowded environment, one expectation that I have is, if I magically switch off the charges, I better recover all the beautiful results that have been accumulated and demonstrated to be valid for neutral polymer cases in the literature over the past 30, 40 years. That is, at least I should get that. Okay. So, therefore, the ideas that we have learned in the neutral polymer cases must be present in any description of a polyelectric solution in crowded environments. Okay. What are those ideas? In addition to what are specific to polyelectrolytes, what are those ideas? And I want to tell you, this must be, I hope this is a take-home message. There are at least four important features that I must include in a description of thermodynamics and dynamics of polyelectrolytes in drug solutions. These ideas are the following. The first is something that we all have discussed this week. That is electrostatic screening. You're going to have some simply bare interaction like 1 over R, and that will be screened like this. And that is a feature for sure. The second feature is, must be a consequence of this adverse screening. Suppose I don't have charges at all. If I have only a polymer, neutral polymer, then we know that this polymer monomer knows that this monomer is connected to this by long-range correlation. And when we increase the concentration of the polymers, neutral polymers, we know very well established fact by beautiful work by many, many people, is that the bare interaction, which is a short-range interaction, W pseudo-potential short-range interaction, now is getting converted into an effective interaction of this type at higher concentrations. At lower concentrations, it will be a bare interaction like this. At higher concentrations, it will be like this. So what we have to do is, okay, that's another screening. And the question here is, of course, if it's not a short-range interaction, what would happen if it were to be a Coulomb interaction? What would be the consequence of this idea when the bare interaction is Coulomb interaction? Or other way of looking at this is, if these charges are not randomly distributed, if they were correlated by the connectivity of the polymer, what would happen to this device screening? Okay, we can look at both ways. In terms of dynamics, there is another thing that we have to worry about, which is the following. Suppose I have a force field on this monomer that will propagate through this viscous medium, hydrodynamic medium, to give me the velocity field of this monomer. And this hydrodynamic interaction also goes like 1 over R minus R prime in dilute solutions. When we add more polymers, that long-range interaction is also screened. This is the hydrodynamic screening. So I have to worry about this triple screening. But they're all coupled together, so I have to do them in a self-consistent way. And furthermore, there is also a coupling of counter-ions. When this monomer is moving, the counter-ions are around, and those counter-ions would be following the movement of this monomer. So there is a coupling with the countermeasure as well. So these are the four issues that we need to worry about. To give you a very quick strategy of computational strategy, how we go about, in view of a very elegant discussion that we had from Michael earlier. Okay, I'll try. The starting point is this. So this is my Coulomb soup, similarly charged polymers. The charges are attached to permanently the polymer, and the counter ions, and salt ions, and solvent molecules. The very bare interaction is, of course, Coulomb interaction, LB is Biram length. This is charge on the monomer. ZP is the charge, the effective charge of the monomer. It could come from various sources, counter ion condensation, on and on. And this is the hydrophobic part, the interaction between two monomers of the polymer, which is short-ranged. So now, the first step that we do is to integrate these counter ions and also salt ions and also solvent molecules. And we do indeed use Hubbard-Stratton-Whitch transformation. Nothing wrong with that. That's formally exact. But what do you do afterwards is the issue. Right? So we use Hubbard-Stratton-Whitch transformation to do this. If you do this, what happens is that the free energy density has two parts now. The free energy density would be coming from the bath, that is FB, and then for the polymer. So what is, by doing this exercise, what do? We get the Debye-Hückel term, which we should, and then we get the entropy of mixing term, and the Flory-Huggins mean scale two-body interaction terms. Mm-hmm. Now, the kappa is dictated by the counter-ion density and the densities of salt ions are distributed, small ions which are distributed here. So you should not leave this rosy out. You know, kappa scale depends on counter-ion because those are the ones which are integrated out. But in this process, the potential, the electrostatic potential now is not that anymore. It turns out to be a Debye-Hückel. So now this is my starting point.
The polymer also
enters
into the free.
No.
What is
rho gamma salt ions, sodium chloride, for example. Those are those ions. So polymer does not enter into this because I did not integrate the polymer out here.
Which approximation of the Hubbard
RPA. At this level, it's RPA. So that's very well known. This is one way to get to Debye-Hückel. The second step is to decouple these chains. These chains are all coupled, so, you know, decouple them by looking at the collective effects of all these chains. So you convert this problem, the potential interaction between two points, to be a charged particle in a field created by all other charges in here. And again, you do Hubbard-Stratton-Whitch transformation and then do the analysis. If you do this, the free energy density for the polymer part now has the following description. When you do this decoupling, then there are N chains, but the effective interaction between segments is different. It is not this interaction anymore. It will be an effective interaction mediated by all other chains. I mean, there are N such chains. So the free energy density for the polymer will be given by given this term, and the effective interaction determines what the free energy is. Right? And we need to calculate this, and we can calculate them. Now, what are the results? The results are, these are the limiting laws based upon this calculation. The feature of this calculation is that the various quantities, free energy density, correlation length, the radius of gyration of a labeled chain in semi-dilute conditions, they all recover this well-known semi-dilute solution laws for neutral polymers for the high salt limit, which we should. In the high salt limit, it should be neutral, like a neutral solution. So we recover all of them. And at the same time, the direct implication of these laws for the low salt limit would be deep loss. Okay. So again, there was a question about free energy density. That goes like a road to the 3/2 according to this formula. Now I'd like to make two remarks. One remark is let me go to neutral polymers again. When I go to neutral polymer chain, the bare interaction is modified into this effective interaction due to the screening induced by topological connectivity of these chains which are mediating this interaction. And indeed, this correlation length depends upon the density, like C to the minus 3/4 in semi-dilute solutions, C to the minus 1/2 in constant solutions. And the question is, what happens to this effect if it is not a short-range interaction, if it were to be simply Debye-Hückel repulsive long-range interaction, depending upon the Debye length, it's short-range or long-range, right? What would happen to this effect if that were to be you have a type interaction. The result is, but what would we intuitively expect? Even for the neutral case, please notice the sign here. There is a correlation length. This looks like a Yukawa type. So there is a correlation length. That depends on density. That's one effect coming from topological correlations. Now, in the case of polyelectrolytes, the leading term would be screened column, and the typical length scale is dictated by the Debye length. So one is repulsive with a typical range to be Debye length. The other one is attractive with similar type of the Debye length. I mean, the equivalent of Debye length would be this Edwards length. Right. So by superposing these two, what we would intuitively expect is to produce an attractive part, attraction at large distances. But if you do the analysis, that's precisely what happens. Let's take a typical situation for a given ionic strength. If I look at the effective interaction as a function of distance, at the low densities of polyelectrolytes, it is purely repulsive. When I increase the concentration of polyelectrolyte, I produce attraction at a distance. The typical depth of this attractive potential is about, in units of kT, is about 10 to the minus 2 per segment, per Kuhn segment. Okay. And the range of this could be anywhere between 50 angstroms to 100 angstroms. So, the effective potential as a function of the distance, this is a low concentration of polyelectrolyte. When you increase the concentration of polyelectrolyte, it goes like this. It becomes attractive. And I also want to point out that this effect becomes weaker if the soil condition is higher. Okay?
So if your poly ion would become a rich optic, would you still produce it?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So let me... That takes me to the second remark. Can I take your question, Mike, a little later? Yeah, because I'm pressed for time. Okay, so let's see what happens. So if I take rigid rods as an example, in the based upon Anthagoras' argument, the density that you need to make the isotropic pneumatic transition would go like a 1 over length of the rod squared and 1 over diameter. Right. So when I charge them, I would imagine the effective diameter to be larger. Therefore, I would expect this transition from isotropic pneumatic to take place at a lower density. That's what I naively expected, as was pointed out in many, many papers. Okay? But that's not true. The reason why it's not true is the following. I start with this Debye Hückel pot between two monomers, and knowing the orientations of them, and putting this Anthagar pot, I do an expansion spherical harmonics. Right? And then to force this into a Meyer sulfate form. If you force this into a Meyer sulfate form, I get this part. P2 is Legendre polynomial. U0R, U1R, U2R, they are all complicated functions of Baylor length, the Debye length, L and D, but they are all repulsive. But the important thing is that these two terms would imply that these rods have to be perpendicular to the separation between them. Suppose I have one rod like this, another rod like this, right? They like, based upon second term, they prefer to have this orientation or this orientation. Because this would be minus 1. Both terms would be minus 1. Therefore, that would be the lower energy. Based upon the third term, it would prefer for these two rods to be preferring like this. Because electrostatic interaction would try to make this orientation more preferable because that's the least repulsion that you can possibly find. So, in fact, this was very beautifully discussed, very early paper, Dujan, Pincus, Phil, Velasco, and Brochard. It was a very beautiful paper. They looked at the possibility of getting a cubic phase as a stable phase when it orders. And it was also pointed out by Wodak in a different circumstances. In any case, based upon this calculation, that's indeed what happens at low densities. Then doing the same analysis that I did, with taking the collective effect into account, and the attraction between, effective interaction between a pair of segments in units of kT is this, as a function of distance over the separation Kuhn length between two segments, two charged segments in the polymer. And as you see, when I increase the ionic strength, the interaction becomes weaker and weaker. So the consequence, and also, this attraction is also strongest when this is the orientation. Just like in even the bare potential, that's the preferred orientation. Even when there's a collective effect, that is the preferred orientation. So this has a very interesting consequence of stabilizing electrostatic interactions, stabilizing the isotropic phase. So in the case of neutral rods or high fall conditions, the isotropic numerical transition would take place somewhere here. But if it's low ionic strength, if it is charged more and it's not screened well, then it gets postponed to higher densities. And it has its own corollaries and on and on. So finally, I'd like to comment on... Can I have 5 minutes, please?
I think three, because then we have less time for questions.
Okay. I'll try. So let me tell you what the phenomenology is first. In the case of a diffusion coefficient from dynamic light scattering, there are two experiments here. In a low concentration, when I take low polyelectric concentration, a very dilute solution, high salt, then it's like a neutral case. And the diffusion coefficient that is measured is exactly what you would expect based upon our knowledge about neutral polymers. Okay. It's the Stokes-Einstein formula. That's exactly what you observe. But now, when you decrease ionic strength, as we heard earlier today, and it's intuitively obvious, the chain would expand. Because when I decrease ionic strength, there is no screening. Therefore, there is some repulsion between the monomers. The chain will become bigger. When the chain becomes bigger, then I would expect the polymer chain to diffuse slower. That is, the diffusion coefficient would be smaller. That's what I would expect. But that's not true. In fact, what happens at a low ionic strength, low concentration of the polymer, but low ionic strength, the diffusion coefficient turns out to be something like this, 2 orders of magnitude larger, and it's comparable to the diffusion coefficient of small ion, okay, in dilute solutions. Now let's do another experiment. These are the guys who did these experiments, Stefan Foster and collaborators, Sellack and Amos, for different polymers. And also these similar data are known in the biological community over the past 20 years. So let's do another experiment where the polyelectric concentration is very high and the ionic strength of the polymer solution is small. So CS is small, but this concentration changes by 3 orders of magnitude in semi-dilute solutions. There, again, the diffusion coefficient that is observed is independent of concentration over 3 orders of magnitude and independent of molecular weight. Okay, this is a faster diffusion coefficient. And also people have measured another slow mode, which I don't have time to comment on right now, unless there are questions later on. Okay, how do we understand this? Since I'm pressed for time, let me tell you what the essential physical issue here is. The essential physical issue here is, if I look at the transport of these monomers, the continuity equation that one would write is like this, d by dt rho, and that's the flux. Typically, for the neutral cases, the flux would be given by this cooperative diffusion coefficient, which we can calculate by accounting for all those effects, gradient of density. Okay. But in addition to this, for polyelectrolytes, there is an additional contribution. That additional contribution is, since these monomers are charged, they will be also a convective term, because it will be coupled to that electrophoretic mobility, that will be coupled to the electric field induced by the environment. Environment meaning the counter ions and other charges in the system. So now, by using Poisson's equation, I can rewrite del dot E in this way. So this is density, that EI is related to the total density of the system. That is the density of the monomers, and this is the density of the counter ions and various ions in the system. So you write similar equation of motion for the counter ions. But we know that the small ions would relax much quicker than the large macro ions. So assuming that term is going to be zero, analytically we can solve this. So d rho by dt would be this coupled diffusion coefficient times del square rho, and this is the one that is measured experimentally. But the important thing to notice is this decoupled has two contributions. One is this usual diffusive part, and this is from the convective part, coupled electrophoretic part, mobility part. And by putting in the numbers, calculating the electrophoretic mobility, this dominates over this one. And in fact, the results are, in the low salt, it recovers all the results that are obtained experimentally. So I'm going to finish. The chairman is standing up. So let me try to conclude. What happens from these calculations? Not only I will make one comment and then conclude. One comment is, by using these analyses, You can calculate the self-diffusion coefficient, cooperative diffusion coefficient, coupled diffusion coefficient, viscosity, modulus of the system in dilute solutions, in semi-dilute solutions, and frequency dependence, and on and on. Everything that I have gotten in here are in agreement with the experimental data, provided you take care of these four effects together. Okay. So now, how do we want to conclude? So this is nice. This is really nice, but there's a huge gap between where I ended and where I started. Okay. But nevertheless, there is also a huge gap between what we can do and what we are doing now from an experimentalist point of view. Using these ideas, putting in more effects, we can play an infinite number of games to make newer materials between what we are able to do right now and what Mother Nature does so beautifully well. With those comments, thank you very much. Beg your pardon? In the light scattering measurements, we
experimental data
are from light scattering.
Okay.
But
that's the difference. I mean, in my talk yesterday, I gave a hint that I have to go to another leaf system. Your method isn't there. You can try and another leaf system volume.
Right. So that's why I pointed out there are many diffusion coefficients. There is tracer diffusion coefficient, there is a mutual diffusion coefficient, and on top of that, there is a coupled diffusion coefficient. The coupled diffusion coefficient has two parts, the mutual diffusion part plus coupling with the counter-ion cloud. Okay, so we need to distinguish all these three things separately. I'm not understanding your question here.
So supposing you have two helicoil polymers, if I understand it, and the helices attract more strongly, let's say, than the coils, or repel more strongly. Have you addressed that?
Yes, the other limit, yes. But I don't have the transparency to show you. We can do the same or equivalent exact calculation for the other limit, where the coil regions would go to the surface more preferentially than the helix. And you'll have, again, coupling of this phase transition, promotion of helical transition into, you know, a nice phase transition.
So if you have a solution of such polymers, which can undergo helix coil, but with a coil-coil interaction from a helix-helix.
No, I have not done that. That would be the next thing to do. I have not done that.
I have a comment from that point. That was done 15 years ago in Russia. In this case, too, this promotes the coil model transition to the first order and promote helix coil transition to the
I see. I did not know. Please, I'd like to know the reference here.
No problem. But I have a question. You mentioned something about formation of some diagrams for what you call chromosome. Was that your son three-like diagram? And if that was three-like, then what is the problem?
No, there is the parameterization is the following. I know from empiricism, all of us know from empiricism, so here is an anchoring complex, that is a mess of lots of proteins, and then we make a long loop here. This is in the interface. There is one loop like that, and then another loop like this, right, on and on. Now, what we know from the experimentalist is that eventually when you go into the mitotic phase, they all cooperatively cling together to make a very long object where these loops are bunched together. Okay, so this is the phenomenology. So the mapping here is that one loop with this anchoring complex would be equivalent to a residue in the usual helix coil mapping problem. That would be one residue. So I put a parameter for the cooperativity of these residues to propagate. Right. And when you do, you know, if you please look at the diagrams here, we sum all of them, not only tree ones, but also all of the branches also. So you can.
But your field is very concentric. Yeah, there is a chromosome.
Correct. Correct. Right.
Yeah, it's hard to see how you put the excluded volume.
Right. But right. The excluded volume appears in this analysis, excluded volume appears through this effective step length that I told you before. Right. It appears to the effective step length. The ionic strength, everything is surrogated by this effective step length. But that is not good enough if you have to worry about if the Gaussian distribution, the susceptible exponent is 1 for a Gaussian chain. So when you worry about the probability with which you are going to make a loop, you have to be very careful. But the saving grace, if I may say so, is that if you look at the dimensions of these anchoring complexes, they are not very small. They are already very large. So it really doesn't return back to its origin. It is always comes to some cutoff length which is very large. So therefore, it seems to be okay to make this exercise. But only time will tell whether this is a fruitful exercise or not. This is, I'm trying to capture this cell cycle with just two parameters and see how that is going to take place. Perhaps this is sparse. I don't know. But you got to start somewhere.
Theory for absorption, you just use the Yukawa potential. But
right.
If you have a highly charged surface, then you would presume that there will be a lot of contraions, and exactly in the layer where your polymer will condense, this nonlinear effect, which comes from the layer, double layer, would be extremely important.
Absolutely, absolutely right. Not only this particular question in this particular context, everywhere these issues come about. When I calculate the dynamics, I have to worry about the relaxation of the contraions, nonlinear effects. Near a surface, you know, what is the actual charge distribution? These are all very important, very complicated questions. But please, I want to give you the message here that my objective here is not to polish the quantitative prefactors here. That's not my objective because that's very difficult for me to do. Here, these are all with the simple analytical calculations to capture the essential features of the important factors dictating the variety of problems. So that's what I'm trying to do here. But you are absolutely right. You know, the real game. It's too complicated.
But your argument, roughly, if I understand it, I just want to make sure I understand it. If I think of this absorption, you're saying, well, you're going to take all of these factors into one
effective charge density.
And then if I look at those phase diagrams you have, well, you're quite happy to see the curves move around quite a bit, maybe even become re-entrant or something of that sort.
Absolutely.
As long as it doesn't change completely the picture, because you can have so many contraries that they would neutralize the surface and you wouldn't get the condition at all.
Well, it's a prefactor game. I agree with Michael. Yeah. That's the, yeah.
Okay, then let's end the session and thank the speaker again.
Thank you.